This episode is brought to you by Burlap and Barrel, a public benefit corporation working directly with smallholder spice farmers around the world to source unique, beautiful spices for professional chefs and home cooks.
This week on a special bonus episode of Meat & Three, we find out how Brexit could be changing the way that Brits eat.
If you're not getting your food from the European Union, where Britain gets 30% directly, well, where are you going to get it from? As I put very succinctly, bye-bye fresh peaches from Italy, hello tinned peaches from Florida. Bye-bye fresh oranges, hello tinned oranges. Bye-bye free-range beef, hello hormone-injected beef.
Tune in to hear about the UK's struggle to stabilize its food system on Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Bill Creelman, founder of Spindrift, the first sparkling water made with real squeezed fruit. Spindrift has pioneered the beverage industry into an age where transparency and traceable ingredients are key, and works with family farms to source their fresh fruit across the country. Last year, Spindrift was on Inc. magazine's list of fastest-growing companies and is available everywhere from Kroger to Sweetgreen and Starbucks to heavy hitters like Haven's Kitchen Cafe, where we sell a lot of Spindrift. Maybe not quite as much as Starbucks, but, you know, we're close. Not for nothing, Spindrift gives 1% of their sales to environmental organizations as members of 1% for the Planet. Bill, I am so psyched you're here. I think I've been psyched for several months now. You are a huge inspiration to a lot of founders. You're someone in this industry who's universally well-liked and admired. And I remember out of all of the speakers that kind of came into the Chobani incubator, you definitely had some things that stuck with me and that kind of ring in my ears all the time. So welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
I'm
this
glad
is a
you're
treat.
Here.
This
Yay.
Is a treat.
I know that there's a lot of advice that I want to kind of like extract out of you, but I also do think it's helpful for people to kind of know about your background and where you grew up. You grew up on a farm in Western Massachusetts.
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just a little town called Leverett and then Deerfield. So very lucky. Didn't realize it at the time, but incredible spot surrounded by other farms and ended up being, as it turned out, really important just as a kind of a foundation for where food comes from.
Do you remember, when you were little, sort of an appreciation for food, or it was just kind of something that showed up that you kind of took for granted? And B, do you remember what you wanted to be when you grew up?
So I fell in love with food at a really early age. Like, I was the kid who, you know, ordered lobster, you know, stroganoff or something at age six.
Yep.
And I definitely remember knowing where food came from. I mean, we would clip our mint for mint carrots.
Yeah,
and
so cool.
You know, the eggs were from underneath the barn, you know, so that, and there was something happened then for sure. I didn't know that I was going to go on to do something in food, but I think what was happening then is you saw people working with food and then turning that into a living.
Right.
And I don't, maybe those were just the people that were around us. So I equated pretty early on this idea that you could do something in food.
As a career.
Yeah. As a career.
Do you remember being like, I feel like founders tend to say, I remember I would take my dad's old socks and I would package them and then sell them at school.
Yeah.
Or like, do you remember being entrepreneurial back then? Or
so the Massachusetts redemption laws passed in 1982. I was eight.
Uh-huh.
And we used to collect cans on the side of the road.
Yep.
And turn them in for 5 cents. And if you got enough, you could afford to buy some candy for the week. And we would drive my mom crazy pulling over constantly as we drove the street.
Picking up the cans, yeah.
There were a lot of cans available when it first switched. And then we started doing other businesses like that. Not all of them around food, but we were always trying to kind of fashion a business out of something right. that we enjoyed.
It tends to be like a through line. There's like the entrepreneurial or like the very enterprising, you know, like just like the workhorses. They tend to also, you know.
My brother was really industrious that way. I remember we didn't have a TV as a kid growing up, and he made enough money collecting these cans to buy a black and white TV for $13 at a tag sale. And so, you know, we did, I don't know. It was silly, but it was.
So you had the bug.
We had the bug.
Yeah.
Yeah, early on.
So you graduated from college in like 96.
That's right.
Now, so because you started working on boats, so you clearly, hence the Spindrift name, like you're a sailor.
Yeah. I would say I'm
a boater.
I like being around water. My family was interested in that, and I became interested in it. So, yeah.
And was there, dumb question, sorry. Was there water where you lived?
No, not at all. We had a river.
Okay.
So we were going out to the Cape. My mom's family is from South Dartmouth, New Bedford, that area. And I would say that's where we spent a bunch of our time.
Right.
And then the reason we went to the Cape and Islands is the house we eventually moved into, they had a connection out there. And so we just piggybacked on their family's
house. Got it. So you graduated from college. You met your wife in college.
That's right.
And you guys decided to move to the Cape together?
Yeah. So she had the... I think she would look back and say the unfortunate, you know, pleasure of meeting me at a time when I was, you know, trying to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do. And I guess that's maybe not true of all relationships, but so we started, she lived with me on Nantucket for a bunch of time. And we were living in a 2-car garage that had been split up into a 4-bedroom apartment. So if you sort of visualize the length of
why Nantucket?
So this is where that family ended up going. So this was not maybe the Nantucket that is
today
that we all sort of think of. It was, you know, very much kind of out in the middle of nowhere and a real like working sort of a sea shack. not winterized. And then one of my captains offered to let us live in his garage. So I think where you're going is this fascination with food continued. And now I'm on a boat. I was living in the boat, and then I was living in this garage. But it's infectious. I mean, you're around the docks, you're around fish and food, and the restaurant culture out there is super interesting and a little bit, you know, intoxicating. I mean, if you're 19 or 20, you're interested in these things. And so that, I guess, solidified what it probably at the time is more of a passing interest into something that I figured I think I want to maybe try to do this after school.
Right. And so that first business that you started out there was basically like a mail order business for Nantucket-ish types of foods, but to get people to buy them year round.
Exactly right. So I'm just trying to find an angle into this food world.
Right. And
I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I had no formal background in any of this. And so, but it was intuitive to me to say, okay, people love these things for 3 months and then they can't get them for 9. So how can we make them available and
figure out a way to get them to them?
And it was a chance to work with these incredible island purveyors, you know, the guy who made the smoked bluefish pate and the lobster guys and the fishermen. And so that was really the basis for what was called Nantucket Harvest.
And what was the demise of Nantucket Harvest?
Profitability.
What's that?
that was the first of many hard lessons, which is that the mail order food business, particularly predating the internet.
Yeah, I mean, predating the internet. Not even like.
Now I'm really aging myself.
Yeah. Maddie, what year were you born?
95.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, cool. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks. We need something stronger than spinach, I think. But yeah, so we that business is extremely seasonal. So think like Harry and David and Dean and DeLuca, kind of those
holiday.
Were the guys, the holiday. So for 6 weeks of the year, we were just cranking. I mean, we were moving a lot of Nantucket Bay scallops around and even Juice Bar Ice Cream. I don't know if anyone knows these are real institutions. But then the rest of the year was really, really quiet. Yeah,
and you have to make a lot of money in 6 weeks to...
Which we were not.
Right.
We really weren't doing. I remember the horrible night, like in, you know, December 29th, when all of the receivables had come in and all the bills were there, and I had like the pile of, you know, sales and then the pile of bills due, and I realized like the one on the right was much bigger than the one on the left. And,
yeah.
And so... You know, it turned into a hard lesson, which is that, you know, obviously this is going to be a long road. But the upshot is we, one of the vendors that we are selling through the catalog was called Nantucket Offshore Seasonings. And it was this great dry rub for grilling. And so we thought, okay, well, maybe during the rest of the year, we'll offer these seasonings, and that's how we got started in the wholesale side of the business.
So that rub eventually turned into a margarita salt with seasoning in it that then turned into stirrings.
That's right. Yeah. We ran both for a while. So we had a mail order business in the winter during the holidays, and then we had this wholesale business. And one of the products we developed was the first, you know, rimming salt or sugar think like, you know, now circa 2001, Maddie was now six. And we were...
Maddie, do you remember they came in these big tins and you could open them and then you would just take your cocktail glass and dip it in the... Do you remember that? As a six-year-old? Yeah, that was... Because you were in Nantucket.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
Oh, you were? Okay.
Yeah, so
okay, you're right. Okay, so you may have seen these products around... But we,
I mean, now they're
not
they're,
that product, but unnecessary.
which was, I mean, it for, you know, in retrospect, looking back at a stirrings, right? There were Bloody Mary mixes, and there were sort of, I think, like Jose Cuervo probably had some sort of like sugar situation. But you were kind of doing a little bit what you've done with Spindrift for that category and making it a little bit more real and a little bit cleaner ingredient panel. And
I think you're exactly right. And that was, I mean, I don't want to, you know, diminish that. I mean, that was an incredibly important time for us,
right?
You know, to have a cocktail category like seemingly emerge, you know, like from nowhere and have all these premium spirits like suddenly. I mean, it was everywhere.
Cocktails I graduated college in 94.
Yeah.
And I remember having like a brunch for my friends and like making Cosmos or whatever it was with stirrings.
I rode your train or your ramp.
Yeah.
Well, so it was, you're exactly right. It was like Lava Lamp, you know, Jose Cuervo,
right.
Mr. and Mrs. T's, that type of product. A clear opportunity to improve the ingredient decks. And so, and we were lucky. And I think what we realized at the time that informed Spindrift was like the importance of timing too, because these things don't last forever.
Right. Yeah.
So we needed to go after it, and we did. And we ended up, you know, I think creating an awesome product. It was really fit with what consumers were thinking about. And so that's exactly right. That became.
Served. And you sold that.
Right.
Did you know going in that was a goal? Was it just time for you? Was it like, I don't know how I can make this any better? Or
so Diageo actually approached us after the Wall Street Journal did a profile on the business. Literally, they shot an email into our, like, you know,
that must
stirrings
have been fun.
Info at stirrings.com. And we read in, we're like, that's interesting. Who's Diageo?
Right.
You know, why would they be interested in us?
Right.
So, no, I wouldn't say we were thinking about it at all. I think we were in a good way just focused on growing the business.
Right.
And we were, you know, grateful for any order we had and that people were excited about the brand. It was not calculated at all. But once we learned who they were and we thought about the strategic advantage of having like gigantic liquor company involved. We got pretty excited about it.
Yeah. So what would you say, because so that chapter winds up and now you're kind of, you know, you have a little bit of cash, you have two businesses under your belt, and you know, did you know you wanted around three? Did you know you wanted another business? Were you like, okay, I'm only going to do it if it fits into these parameters, or if I do this again, I'm not going to make this mistake again? Or like, were you super thoughtful about it, or were you literally just sitting there putting lemon in your seltzer and you're like, oh, here we go?
So I mean, first of all, I was exhausted. I mean, I think these businesses after 10 or 12 years, you know, you just, it's fatiguing.
Yes.
That's one. Two is, it was also the way that we ended up exiting Diageo was hard. It was sort of the financial crisis. It was not, we had imagined partnering for many years beyond. So, and I guess, but more there was a sense that there was an unresolved, there was like something that hadn't really happened. And so I wouldn't say I was thinking, I'm gonna go around, do another business. I actually really don't like the serial entrepreneurial thing. I think that kind of has a negative, like, oh, you're just churning out businesses. So for me, it needed to come from an authentic place.
Right.
So I wasn't in any great rush. But I was interested in the sparkling side of the Stirrings business. We had a tonic and a ginger ale and some things, and where those products were available, they sold really well, and people liked them.
Right.
And so for me, it was kind of natural to start then thinking about maybe going into that space.
So why don't we take a break?
Yeah,
and when we come back, we're going to talk about going into the space and everything you kind of took from those past businesses and applied to starting Spindrift.
I'm Ethan Frisch, co-host of Why Food and co-founder of Burlap and Barrel, a public benefit corporation working directly with smallholder spice farmers around the world to source unique, beautiful spices for professional chefs and home cooks. We set our partner farmers up to export their own crops for the first time, and they get access to a whole new market here in the U.S., and we get access to spices that other companies can't source. We're honored to work with restaurants including 11 Madison Park, Blue Hill, and Chez Panisse, as well as thousands of home cooks across the country. Visit us at burlapandbarrel.com.
I'm back with Bill Creelman, founder of Spindrift. Okay, so the folklore is that you are tired, you've sold this company, you're sitting at your kitchen table, you're going for like your weekly or your daily, I don't know, drink, you squeeze a lemon in your seltzer water, and like the idea light bulb comes above your head, and then the rest is history, and now you're selling, you know, millions and millions and millions of bottles of, you know.
So that isn't
is that not
maybe not quite although that would be amazing if it all happened.
It'd be a nice cartoon.
It would be a great cartoon. I think I'd say pieces of it are definitely right, which is I love carbonation. That I was a big Diet soda guy. I think it was just a product of like the 90s and 2000s when everyone seemed to drink Diet Coke. I have a bunch of kids, and I think if you're, you know, if you grow up on a farm and you're a natural food kind of guy, at a certain point, you're going to start to scrutinize your own soda habit, soda consumption habit. And really that's what it was for me.
And this was 2009. Okay.
So I was sort of now finally free to do some self-examination.
Yeah.
And soda was one of those things.
And right before, I mean, Michael Pollan, like I kind of think of the world in food as like before Omnivore's Dilemma and after Omnivore's Dilemma. And that was 2010.
Right.
So there was definitely a little bit of like, aside from sort of like the hippie culture, which was always like against sort of quote unquote big food, there was this kind of like understanding a little bit more of sustainability and sugar and choices. But it wasn't out there yet. It was still not
Well, I think the other thing was there was not a lot of entrepreneurship going on in general in the country at that time. Right. I mean, it was like right at the end of the Great Recession, right. And
people weren't starting things.
Yep. I mean, people were just trying to figure out how to keep the lights on if they were in business, yep. or get a mortgage or a loan if they were thinking about getting in business. And so I don't know, it didn't necessarily feel like a natural time, but as far as Spindrift, the idea was very simple. It truly occurred in our kitchen in Charlestown, and we were just sort of, I was just playing around and thinking, okay, now what if I could make a product like fresh lemon and sparkling water? Like, wouldn't that be great? And then I tried it and I said, okay, I just made it. It wasn't that hard. How do I duplicate that flavor at scale?
Yeah.
And I think that is every food entrepreneur's challenge.
But you knew what a challenge it would be from your prior experience.
I did.
Unlike me, who was like, I can make this in the cooking school. Can't be that hard to make a million pouches a year.
I did know enough by then that it was going to be super hard.
Yeah.
The real light bulb moment from that early stage of our development was realizing that no one had done it. Right. You know, there really was no, either domestically or even internationally, I could not find someone that had done a similar process to that. And that is an important moment for an entrepreneur, because I just didn't want to go into something that had already been, played out. And it was important to me to really find white space that we
could do something into. Actually. Yeah. So what were, do you remember your first couple of steps, or like, okay, I'm going to take out my pen now, and these are the things that I need to get thinking about?
I really wasn't even thinking about starting a business. Like, it wasn't, because I was phasing out of one and hanging out with my kids and working on it when I could. And which I think is, by the way, like a great way to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't feel this pressure to create a business. Right. I had no thought of scale at this point, or we need to hit these numbers at this time. Mm-hmm. It was more like, if I can create a product that's really good and I'm proud of, then there must be an audience out there. But I will say, so the other outside external factor was soda was like starting to collapse.
Yep.
So this was like Bloomberg pushing through soda taxes. California was working on some legislation. I was interviewed like a couple months into business somehow. Someone asked me like my opinion on stuff. Right. And so there was this sense that the world was changing and that soda was finally starting to really kind of fall. And so the other part of it was, okay, I like this product. I see this big macro trend that's going to take a long time to play out. Could this be an answer to that?
Yeah.
And that was really, that's what happened.
It seems like the perfect balance of like sort of tunnel vision, but also like 30,000 feet in the air, you know? So you knew what you were doing specifically, but you also, you know, sometimes I think founders, especially, we fall so in love with our product and we're not looking around at any sort of market, anything. And then we realize there are like four people who are going to buy it. They're going to love it. But there are only four people.
That's fair.
Yeah.
And I think it was, so cocktail mixes were also a pretty small category.
Right.
They weren't consumed all that frequently. And that turned out to be a challenge for us as we thought about scale. So
that had to influence something.
So to think now about soda, which is arguably on the like total other end of that consumption, or water eventually.
Right.
That was really exciting, because you know that someone's going to have this a lot.
Right.
If you're successful. And so I felt that gave me that confidence to really start to push.
And what was the first product?
So the first products, or there were four of them, were the glass bottle sodas. 2010, almost actually 10 years ago to the day of today.
Right.
And there were four. It was lemon, orange, mango, grapefruit, and blackberry.
And they were in those little or big?
They were in a glass, like what you would think about as being a clear glass soda bottle.
And what were they made with?
So they were made with a whole bunch of unpasteurized fresh juice.
Wow.
They had a little bit of cane sugar, and they had natural flavors.
Right.
Because, and they were refrigerated. So that was the other, so the, I might have skipped over, but the reason no one had done it, well, I quickly found out, is because the bottles, if you're not careful, explode. And you know, and when you use real fresh ingredients, they're alive. And right. So you really, you know, think milk or, you know, dairy or sort of anything that has a short shelf
fresh
life.
Fresh sauce.
Fresh sauce. Yeah. You know now, you're right in your space. So yeah, I had to now keep them cold and develop a fresh supply chain,
right.
Which as you're learning is
super fun.
Mm-hmm. So now we had to refer, you know, soda and these ingredients were challenging enough. Now we had to basically go into a network that didn't want them.
Right.
Because they didn't want glass on their trucks. They didn't want to bother with
keeping them cold.
Yeah. So, and then the retailers didn't particularly want to keep them cold either, because as you learn,
they
take up a ton of space.
Yeah.
These are huge, you know, cases.
And so how did you kind of, because I know you were actively involved, like, you were in every store, you were asking all these questions. Yeah. And I guess maybe that's a lesson here. Like, you clearly had to iterate on your initial product. Yeah. It was delicious. It was great. It started off the whole thing, but it's not where you ended. So what were kind of, you know, how did you kind of learn the lessons, and then how did you apply them? And do you remember being like, we need to get this in a can, or we need to get the, you know, along the way?
I wish I had that kind of foresight. Because it really ended up taking like all of those like 3 or 4 years to get there.
It's not that long.
Not to scare you with your own business.
No, it feels short.
So I think I would divide it, like draw a line and put like things were working on one side and things that weren't on the other.
Yeah.
And what I was trying to do is work my way down the things that weren't working side of the list.
That's a great way
to say, okay, refrigeration is challenging. These guys are not happy. The distribution is going to be a problem because, you know, eventually we're going to grow out of milk and fish trucks
right.
in the Northeast. price point at $3 a bottle probably doesn't work long term. What is the multi-pack solution to this? Mm-hmm. If someone wants to buy more than one, are they really going to spend $12 for four?
Right.
And I could go on and on, but those are some that come to mind.
No, but so, really very helpful. I mean, those are things that, you know, again, like we just don't think about. We have these babies and there are products and, you know, it takes some hard looking, like, your baby, you know, might need a haircut.
Yeah. I think I would say and to this day, like, I love this product. I mean, mm-hmm. part of it was that, you know, this simple question, like, can you put four products out into the market in the right place and do they sell? And the wonderful answer was yes. Wanted these products. So the bigger challenge of are they interested at all, I'd started to solve. It was more so I was just grateful to have an audience for that first line.
Yeah.
I think many of us are to start.
Yeah, no, for
and
sure.
And it never felt insurmountable to get there. It just would require time and work and money and all these other things.
So do you remember sort of knowing, okay, like, this is a viable product, now I need to go in and tweak it? Like, do you remember a moment being like, all right, this is actually a business?
So I don't mind sharing. I mean, what we would do is we would always set kind of one, no more than three goals a year. Mm-hmm. And we never took a bigger bite at the apple than that. And basically said, if we can get these three things done, we'll be in a better position to then move forward against the next three behind that.
So would one be in operations, one a sales, and one?
That's like, right.
Is that how
we still do that? We still have basically three headlines. This year we have two. You know, I think it's just impossible.
Is it a sales number goal, or is it like
sales is always a big part of it? But really, sales is often the result of something else. You know, if you've done a great job at this, and this,
right.
It's just the number at the end. If you've done a great job executing, for instance, in trade,
right.
You should have a great sales number. Sales on their own can be a kind of a shallow objective, just on it.
Do you remember early ones? Like, just for people out there listening, do you remember three early objectives?
Yeah, sure. So it would have been like, you know, pioneering, for instance, a second market. So we had been in New England. We were selling okay in, you know, Boston and Burlington, Vermont and Portsmouth, New Hampshire and Western Mass or something. Mm-hmm. And we said, like, okay, but this is probably because people generally, we can, it's our home market. Yeah. It's, you know, it's my home. Mom's buying a lot, yeah, or something. So, you know, what about Washington, D.C. or Southern California? So we actually went out to Southern California.
Right.
And that's when Shelley, our first employee, joined on. And she kind of re-pioneered that market. Yeah. So I think that's a really important one. There would have been one around operations, yeah, for sure. Just, you know, making sure the product was, you know, we could make it at scale. And, you know,
yeah. And I mean, speaking of operations, it took us a while to find a co-packer. To find a co-packer, in our case, that would do the small volume that we were doing. And they ended up investing in the company, which is basically, oh, wow, how we are doing what we're doing. Mm. What was that like for you? Did you co-pack? I mean, did you find someone who was going to take fresh fruit? I'm sure a co-packer looked at you like you were crazy.
Crazy. Yeah, we really upset a lot of people early on. I mean, yeah, it was just...
That's when you know you're doing something right, yeah.
Well, it did feel like a proof point, but we burned bridges and we had, like, we just, you know, blowout fights, you know, the pulp would clog the equipment, they'd lose a week, yeah, of production, or the pulp would show up in someone else's product, like, a week, you know, for like, yeah, 5 days later.
That's not great.
And it was like that. It felt like every run there was something, yeah, like that.
And there's the seasonality of fruit too, right? Like, oh my, you can't, gosh, seasonality get fruit. Strawberries or whatever.
No, you can't. Yeah. So we sort of half knew what we were doing, half we were making it up as we went.
Right.
And, but I would say the consistency of the product was really, for a long time, the biggest challenge. Right. Just how do you make it taste the same each time,
right,
and not, you don't run a batch and kind of cross your fingers that it's going to,
yeah,
be similar to the last time you ran.
In this podcast a lot, I feel like there are a couple of themes that kind of always come up. And one of them is just not oversimplifying in your mind supply chain. I think that because there's been so much money, because there's so many products, and because people buy everything on Instagram, and you have no idea what you're actually getting when you swipe up to buy, there's just a lot out there that you can think you have a really good business with a really good brand. But there's a difference between a brand and a business, and I think a lot of times it comes down to like that supply chain stuff, because there are people out there that have great ideas and it's beautifully packaged, but they don't have a way of making, yeah, the product, and certainly not making it, you know, to scale like you were talking about.
Yeah, you're going to get exposed at a certain point.
Yeah.
And so I guess, like, beverage, I think, is a little bit, it's still the Wild West, and how do you qualify these co-packers, and then how do you graduate from one level of skill to, right, the next? All of that is just as challenging as it's always been. But you know, at least in our world, you're building towards something that that is, you know, that is run in big numbers.
Yeah.
You know, Monster Energy, you know, these are independent brands that are running, you know, billions and millions and billions of cans.
Yeah.
And they don't own their own facilities, so they're running somewhere. Right. And they're
So did it occur to you to build a facility at some point when you were yelling at co-packers were screaming at you?
Yeah, we've talked about that before. We thought about doing our own fresh juice facility. We talked, mm-hmm, about staging facility where everything kind of is where we gather it all and blend it and then redistribute. We've talked, right, about everything. And I would say we still have some conversations about it, but ultimately we found great partners.
Right.
And
which is great.
And with volume, you know, volume in this space cures a lot.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we could go in and we had somewhat regular volume and we could give them some guarantee, right, over time. That really helps.
They were more, yeah, amenable. Okay, so we're going to fast forward a couple of years. You broke into those new markets. You must have, like, crushed your three goals per year for several years in a row.
Crushed them.
Mostly crushing. 2015, you're good. It's like things are happening. You're winning awards. You're selling lots of Spindrift. And then you made a decision.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I would say we were not hitting every metric. I know you're saying it tongue in cheek, but yeah. I mean, we were having tons and tons of challenges along the way. But still, I'd say the proof point was remaining, which is that people were generally interested in the product.
Right.
So we launched the sparkling water profile in 2012. So we now had the soda and the sparkling water.
And the main difference being the lack of sugar.
The lack of sugar.
Right.
And so we were we are now faced with the decision, which is, you know, how do you pull forward two businesses
that are
now increasingly quite different? And the breakthrough really was not, we were not pressured. There was no external pressure to do one or the other. This wasn't, a do or die thing. It was more a choice can we do it? Can we kind of hold true to our own self-imposed rules about being disciplined and simplify to amplify? And I'd say the reason we did it was because we thought the sparkling waters finally tasted good.
Mm-hmm. Without the added sugar. Yeah.
They had been around for a few years and they were okay, I would say, taste-wise, when we were making them well. But in 15 and 16, we really figured it out. We just had invested massively in the process and really, I think, had gotten smart around the decision to get out of natural flavors. We kind of revisited the whole thing. And so, yeah, we decided to retire the sodas and get out of natural flavors entirely.
So you had how many SKUs of soda and how many SKUs of, like, sparkling
water?
We
had six and six at the
time.
And
you basically, you wanted to be done with sugar and you wanted to be done with this sort of, like, netherworld of natural flavor, quote unquote. And so you just decided to stop.
Yeah, we just decided, and it's funny, like we didn't even really think about it as, you know, getting out of. We just thought that the sparkling waters had the chance to replace the experience that the soda was filling.
Right. Which was also, again, tapped into this larger kind of macro trend. Water overtook soda at some point. Yeah. Seltzer was definitely like becoming a thing, not quite as much then as it was sort of in this last year or two. And definitely, I feel like people started really getting on like an anti-sugar kick. But I would imagine that that's a hard decision to make if you're making money and it's going well. So, I mean, what was that like for you? And was your team all on board? And was everyone kind of around you? Or did you have to kind of explain?
Well, I remember, like, you know, being overly confident in order to, you know, make myself feel better about the decision, but also to bring everyone along. But I would say the team, I mean, overwhelmingly, we have an incredible team that saw very early on, we all saw the same opportunity. We also at that time had brought over people that had been in sparkling water. So that helped us really say, like, okay, we sort of see what's happening and imagine if we could re-experience, like, recreate sparkling water. And at first I'd say sparkling water just wasn't as interesting. Like, soda has this kind of lifestyle-iness to it and pizzazz and is fun and, you know, more carefree. Sparkling water was just kind of that boring thing that, you know, all of us kind of had around, but it wasn't, you know, you don't throw a party around sparkling water necessarily.
Not now you do, I
guess.
Well,
now I guess, yeah, now you do. But we did start to
we should have a sparkling water party. Yeah.
And so we started to say, like, well, actually, isn't that what makes it even more fun and interesting?
Right.
That there is no personality, in soda, there's lots of personality.
Right.
Could we bring not just this whole new ingredient conversation, but really, like, energy and humanity and kind of the same brand chops?
Right.
That,
some real feeling.
And it was really that flip of seeing what was, you know, reimagining it as an opportunity that got us super excited.
So you said something a couple minutes ago, and we talked about it before we started recording, because I've heard you say it, and it's simplify to amplify. So I don't know if, you know, how that came into your lexicon, but it, when you've said it, now it's kind of in my lexicon. So whether, and because a lot of times what I would do now is be like, let's talk about sales, let's talk about marketing, let's talk about, you know, blah, blah. But across all of those things, you've really kind of had this discipline to simplify either what you're offering or the process or your messaging or whatever. Everything about your product is simple in order to make sort of maximum impact. And I'd love to hear sort of the background of that, how you apply it, how you would offer to early stage founders to apply it.
Yeah, this was definitely something I learned along the way, because as an early entrepreneur, I would just like you know, I think we all have this instinct of kind of grabbing as much as we can, and we'll figure it out when we get there. Mm-hmm. But what I unfortunately learned just through a lot of, you know, trial and error is that, particularly in a big crowded space like beverage, it's almost impossible to be successful at all, right?
Yeah.
Say it's 1 in 100 chance of getting to scale.
Yeah.
And so at the very kind of simplest level, like if it's hard to get one idea as a breakthrough, right, how are you going to get 2 or 3 or 4? Yeah. And we're all strapped for resources. We're all strapped for line time. We're all strapped for cash, you know, down the list. And so we started embracing this idea, and I don't quite remember the genesis of the actual words, but to say, let's just make sure that if we add something, we're taking something away.
Right.
And so in the case of you know, whether it's the soda example, or we recently retired our 4-packs,
right,
in order to just focus on one product line, and we retired probably a third of our SKUs.
Right.
We've really, I think we've done a pretty good job at doing that. Now it isn't easy. So no, it's actually much simpler
to
ironically to just kind of stay the course,
yeah,
and to not face some of those like harder choices.
Well, I hate to interrupt you, but I literally, it goes through my mind almost daily, whether it's like adding another flavor, you know, taking away one that isn't doing its, you know, what it should be doing, even though it's my favorite, you know, adding another, you know, retailer who wants us, but we're not necessarily ready for. Yeah. It's really hard to say no, or
I think it's the hardest. Yeah. I really do. Like I think especially, I mean, just by the very nature of being, you know, the founder or the person who all of these opportunities are funneled through. I mean, you spend most of your day and you have to be thinking about setting the business up for the next stage of success.
Right.
And so isn't that just naturally adding more and doing more? And I think all of the answer is yes, it's all of those things, but it can't be at the expense of doing what you do really, really well.
And do you have a system for that? Like, is there a mapped out way that you make those decisions for each? You know, someone gave me the advice the other day to have, because I don't want the tail to wag the dog with sales, right? I know that we are not for everyone right now. And yet some of the bigger retailers, they see an emerging brand, they think it's going to bring millennials, they get excited. Someone gave me the advice the other day to make a like conditions,
yeah,
list. I had it in my head. I'd never really written it out. Like, do you have sort of conditions
for everything? In other words, like for a retailer, sure, you can bring us in, but it has to be
under these conditions. We have to, yeah, know that this is going to happen. You have to allow us to, yeah, do demos because we need to.
And our sales, yeah, team is unbelievable at that. Right. Far better than I am, where they. And that just is confidence, right?
Because
you're going to turn people off to,
right,
say, well, geez, we'd love to sell you our product, but you have to take in 6 SKUs,
right,
and we need to be, you know, in this place on the shelf. I mean, that, you know, that's, yeah, hard.
Ours are just like not that hardcore. Ours are like,
no, but
you have to let us do a demo at some, yeah, point. And, you know, we there has to be, we can't be below a certain price or, yeah, whatever it is. Yeah.
No, but the discipline, you're, question, yeah, is, yes, you And it starts just, it should really, it should exist across your entire business. I mean, right. We absolutely still talk about setting goals, and everyone has no more than three. I just don't, and they need to be
simplifying.
Really measurable, you know, and if we can't measure them, then we're probably not going to do them.
Right.
Or it's maybe not the right thing to do for this stage of the business. Right. So, but you need to be purposeful about it, but I do think once you set that as like a cultural expectation, I think it, I hear it now being kind of worked through the company, and that obviously is really been satisfying. But I'd say I want to come back to this idea that we all share that idea, which is very unusual.
Right.
Usually, for instance, sales, you know,
wants to go,
we got to go everywhere. Yep. And ours, we just had a very different view. We wanted to go into one account. Had we set a single goal or a few goals, and that was all we did as a business, and everyone worked on it. You know, Target was a very important customer, has been for a really long time, and everyone from finance to account, you know, the whole company said for 1 year, all we're going to do is make this hugely successful.
Yeah.
And it worked.
It's amazing too, because there is so much pressure. You know, we got to grow fast so that the competition doesn't come up on us or whatever it is. But somehow you've really been able to sort of like hold your space and like throw out some elbows and just like keep it chill.
That's nice of you to say. I mean, it certainly doesn't feel that way every day, but I would say we've played the longer game.
Yeah.
I think we've all done this for a while. We're not enamored by, you know, by kind of some of the sensationalism that goes around the space.
Yep.
We really believe in the product. I mean, I drink like 10 a day.
Yep.
And I think if you have a brand that is based more on like values and mm-hmm. things that are important instead of something that's happening, externally, you set yourself up. You know, we know that the economy is going to do this. Yeah. The new products are going to come in and be super interesting and fun and have a great story and all these things. So we can't worry about that.
Yeah.
We can only focus on the things we can control, which is executing, making great product, getting it in people's hands, having them try it. And ultimately, hopefully, good things will happen as a result of that.
So for our last question, would you say that that's kind of your overarching advice to founders? Or would there be something that you wish someone had told you 20 years ago, 15 years ago?
Gosh, wouldn't that be amazing?
Well,
when Maddie was just starting out in elementary school. I guess my favorite advice, and really it's still something we talk about all the time, is just finding a place to tell your story.
Yeah.
You know, because if you are really if you really focus on finding your audience early on, mm-hmm. they will help you really guide you to where you're going to go from there.
Yeah.
And the opposite, if you just have kind of a like some heat coming off of a lot of places instead of like a really white hot center, it can be really confusing.
Yeah.
So I know I talked about this in Chobani, but I do think that is like, if you focus on only one thing, it's making a few, you know, a smaller number of accounts or a smaller story really successful, and then using that, the energy and the heat from that to really then power you, sort of, you know, the brand forward.
Yeah. You are, I mean, it's interesting. I think that there's like a real return to that fundamental thing. I think it got really easy to launch things super big.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know about the sustainability of that, you know. And I think things are starting to shift back to, you know, real people, real products, you know, sort of the depth that you're talking about.
Yeah, those are some of the values that just will never change. There's a lot that's going to change around food and trends and health, but I guess we hope that that's true, and we aspire to be a brand like that.
Yeah. I think you are a brand like that. So it's really fun watching, and it's just nice when good guys win. So thank you for being
thank
here.
Thank you. This was super fun, Alan.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Matt, thanks for being such a great engineer. I'll be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce. Thanks for listening. In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.